coming up on Morning Ireland, a reprieve for people who can't walk. Minister Kathleen Lynch will tell us why they'll keep their €200 a month help for the moment. Australia's outrage that a serial rapist could be free to kill and rape Jill Maher. Greece shuts down its national broadcaster, leaving cert makers say sorry. And in sport, Irish soccer's big night in New York and Carlo Hurling's big day in Dublin.
It's a minute past eight on RT Radio 1. You're listening to Morning Ireland on Wednesday, the 12th of June, with Gavin Jennings and Cathal McCulloch.
The headlines: a special meeting of the Cabinet is getting underway to discuss the draft Protection of Life During Pregnancy Bill. An organisation that tackles domestic violence in Ireland has reported a significant increase in the number of reports of child abuse. And Turkey's Prime Minister Tayyip Erdogan is due to meet anti-government protesters today following another night of street violence in Istanbul. Brian Jennings has the news in full.
The Cabinet is holding a special meeting to discuss the draft Protection of Life During Pregnancy Bill. If agreed, the wording may not be published until later in the week. The discussion comes after a strongly worded statement from the Catholic bishops criticising the proposed legislation. On his way into the Cabinet meeting this morning, the Taoiseach Enda Kenny said everyone was entitled to an opinion. But he said this legislation was about saving lives and the law needed to be clarified. Our political correspondent, David McCullough.
Political agreement was reached on Monday between Health Minister James Riley of Fine Gael and Junior Minister Alex White of Labour on the details of what should be in the bill. But the technical work by officials of wording the actual legislation took longer than expected, while ministers were also anxious not to rush the discussion of the controversial legislation at the end of the normal weekly Cabinet meeting. This made this morning's special Cabinet meeting necessary, but the welcome the bill gets in political circles may be affected by yesterday's strongly worded statement from the Catholic bishops, which said the legislation would for the first time permit the deliberate and intentional killing of an unborn child. The bishops claim the government is under no obligation to legislate for the X case and that it should allow TDs and senators freedom of conscience on whether to vote for it.
Women's Aid has recorded an increase of 55% in the number of reports of child abuse it received last year compared to 2011. The organisation, which aims to stop domestic violence against women and children, is calling for round-the-clock access to legal protection for vulnerable women and children. Lisa McKelvey reports.
Women's Aid cites 16,200 reports of domestic violence against women made to it last year. In its annual report, the organisation said its helpline dealt with 3,230 cases of direct child abuse in 2012, compared to just over 2,000 cases during the previous year. The report also cites a surge in the level of violence against children in homes where women have been abused. In addition to the instances of direct child abuse, in 1,211 calls, it was reported that children were bearing witness to violence against their mothers. The report shows that threats, abuse, intimidation and violence are a daily reality for thousands of women and children across Ireland. The voluntary organisation is calling for round-the-clock access to legal protection for vulnerable women and children.
On this programme, Margaret Martin, Director of Women's Aid, said the rise in the awareness about child abuse was part of the reason for the higher level of reports received by the organisation. She also said a space had been created for women to talk more about what was happening to them, their children, and the difficulties they faced even when they had left their partners.
About half of the women that we would see would have separated from their partners, have left the relationship, sometimes for a couple of years, but the abuse unfortunately continues. And it continues particularly during access visits. And one of the things that we're really pushing for is that any arrangements that are made about any structures, the safety of the children and their mother needs to be prioritised over contact.
Industrial action by air traffic controllers is expected to spread across Europe today, having started in France yesterday with a strike that grounded a quarter of flights across the country. Workers in 11 countries are expected to take part in today's action. The European Commission, which drafts EU laws, wants to centralise air traffic controls rather than leave each member state to monitor its own skies. But France's main controllers' union, the USACCGT, says the plans are a direct attack on the public service nature of this sector. Unions are concerned that if the plan is introduced, working conditions would disimprove and would amount to a step towards privatisation. Intending passengers are advised to check the status of their flights with their airline before travelling to the airport. Riot police in Turkey have fired tear gas and water cannon to disperse protesters during further clashes in Taksim Square in Istanbul overnight. The square has been the focus of countrywide anti-government demonstrations for almost 2 weeks. Turkey's Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan is to meet some of the protest leaders later today. In Greece, the conservative-led coalition government has closed the national broadcaster ERT to save money. All 2,500 employees have been suspended pending a reorganisation. Viewers watching the main television channel saw the screens go to black last night during a studio discussion. Thousands of people gathered outside the broadcaster's offices in Athens to protest against the closure. Now the time is coming up to 8 minutes past eight.
Here again with it says in the papers is Deirdre Purcell.
Two-thirds of Irish primary school teachers are struggling to teach pupils who are too sleepy and are too hungry to concentrate. That's the main story based on a study of 10-year-olds in the Irish Examiner this morning. The Irish Times leads with Carl O'Brien's story about cuts in funding for a training and advice service for childminders. This, we're told, is despite recent pledges to increase standards in childcare. Events surrounding the trial and conviction of the man who murdered Drogheda woman Jill Maher supply the lead stories for the Irish Daily Star and Irish Sun and make the front page of the Irish Independent. We're told Ms. Maher's father, George McKeown, turned directly to the killer and said simply, "It is not okay to rape and kill my child." The Irish Daily Mirror's lead concerns the stabbing to death of 23-year-old Dean Fitzpatrick, brother of the missing Amy Fitzpatrick. Mr. Fitzpatrick's partner, Sarah O'Rourke, is expected to talk to Gardaí today about threats made to him before his death. The Cabinet yesterday approved the appointment of 6 county registrars, 5 solicitors and a barrister as specialist judges of the Circuit Court. The roles have been created under the Personal Insolvency Act to allow the court to deal quickly with insolvency applications. The 6, who are selected from 9 applicants, include Mary O'Malley, registrar of Fermeath, who began her career at Gallagher Shatter, where the Minister for Justice was a consultant until 2011. That's in the Times. And most papers report on Sean Quinn Jr.'s appearance in court again yesterday. In a bid finally to purge his contempt of court orders, and with his wife's consent, he is to sell his Dublin home, valued at about €400,000 and described as his only owned asset. So what else? Amidst all the talk about school children and exams, today is World Day Against Child Labour. Every day, we're told, millions of children leave home early in the morning, not for school but for work. The Times runs a full-page piece from Lima, Peru, highlighting the plight of the children of one family who start work at 4 a.m. to make bricks. The front page of the Times business section tells us that nearly €8 billion worth of loans held by the IBRC on properties in the UK and Germany are to be put up for sale in October. The headline over the piece is that this is to test the market. While the business section of The Independent leads with the belief within Goodbody stockbrokers that AIB will not repay the €3.5 billion cash it owes to the state. We're told that the Pension Reserve Fund is likely to convert the debt into shares. The Law Society is to deploy undercover secret shoppers in court venues to flush out solicitors who tout for business, an unauthorised practice. That's in The Examiner and elsewhere. And The Examiner also tells us that EU customs officials will have new powers to confiscate and even destroy counterfeit goods sent and received through the post, brought into the state by travellers and importers, even simply passing through the EU on their way to other destinations. And it remains to be seen if a precedent has been set by a court case in which Katie Fortune, who built a small wooden chalet which evolved from a small caravan on her own land beside Loch Dan. She did it without planning permission and was ordered to demolish it by Wicklow County Council. Over 4 years, she applied for retention twice, was rejected twice. Her appeal to Unborth Planola failed too, as did a circuit court challenge. But Judge Gerard Hogan has ruled in the High Court that Ms Fortune has a constitutional right to her home under Article 45 and overturned the demolition order yesterday, awarded her one day's costs. Wicklow County Council is seeking legal advice. And that's in the Times. And finally, from the Independent, and in the Guess What category, he has been Commander-in-Chief, Time Magazine's Man of the Year, and may have hopes of becoming America's first laddie. Step up Bill Clinton, who is now, according to an annual rewarding of the honour, US National Father of the Year.
Morning Ireland, almost a quarter past eight. People who can't walk or find it very difficult to walk on their own will hold on to a monthly payment to help them get about for a little longer while the government works out how to replace mobility allowances. Earlier this year, it was announced that the payment would be scrapped because it should have been available to more people, that the over 5,000 people who were getting the payment would still get it until the end of May, but that after that, new arrangements would be made. Now, a review has been announced and the payment will continue to be made until that's finished, expected to be in October. Kathleen Lynch is Minister of State with Responsibility for Disability and she's in our Dáil studio. Good morning, Minister.
Morning.
For those 5,000 or more people getting this payment at the moment, €208 a month or the half allowance of €104 a month, how long more are they guaranteed to get it for?
Well, until October at least, and it is hoped that a new scheme will be devised so as that we can ensure that this, and you're quite right in your introduction, very vulnerable group of people will feel more secure in the payment that they get. And we were very conscious of their vulnerability from the very start. And I would have to say that I'm most grateful to the disability community who cooperated fully in terms of the review up to this point. And we have now gotten an assurance from Cabinet that we can continue to pay these people until October, until a new scheme will be devised. It won't be completed by October, but that's the deadline which the Cabinet has set us in order to come back and outline exactly what we have in mind.
Let's hear from John Dolan. He's CEO of the Disability Federation of Ireland. He's been giving us his reaction to the news that these payments will continue for the moment.
The very first thing to say this morning is we absolutely have a sense of relief, and there's 4,700 people who share that in their families. Having said that, the fact that they're now in a position to say that the scheme can be on a statutory basis means that that could have been figured out and should have been figured out before the abolishment of the scheme last February. So that is a source of annoyance, and we would be concerned that the department, there needs to be a review of how decisions get made in that department. We had issues last year with the personal assistance. The other issue now that needs to be looked at as well, and it's not to take from the fact that there is relief this morning with this decision, and it's very much welcomed, is that they're absolutely silent about the motorised transport grant, which was also abolished on the 26th of February. That's a sister scheme and a complementary one. So we would be anxious and worried that that's going to be part of the revived package as well.
That was John Dolan. First of all, Kathleen, just to address that point about the motorised transport grant. This is money given to people to make upgrades to their car so that they will be able to use it to get to and from work if they're able to work.
Well, I suppose what we started to look at when we went back to government last week, what we started to look at in May when we finally decided that we had to close both schemes because of pressures of their illegality, what we started to look at, and again the group that came together has done tremendous work in relation to transport on a wider basis for people with disabilities, and this is not just you know, about people who, and the very small group we're talking about that cannot walk in any respect, but indeed all of us as we grow older, is about a transport system that will facilitate everyone, particularly those who acquire disabilities and those who have mobility problems. So the mobility grant will be looked at as well. But as I say, it is part of the review, and that review will now commence.
Does the motorised transport grant money continue till October, just to be clear?
All of the schemes will, both schemes are closed. Both schemes are closed. The motorised transport grant payment is not once a year, but once every 2 years. So, you know, doesn't have the same urgency as the mobility allowance. Is it a different scheme?
And as you said, both schemes are closed. So those who wanted to apply can't, and those whose applications were waiting, they won't get their decision now. For those people, as I said, who are on this up to 200 euro a month, and bear in mind that for the vast majority who receive that full payment, the only other money they get in is some 800 euro a month in disability allowance. So if they were to lose this money eventually, it would be a 20% drop in the money that they use every month. There is still a huge degree of uncertainty. They know they're going to get the money in October, but for all of those who are receiving that payment, can you offer them any guarantee that they will continue to get that money after October?
Well, I can't guarantee that because the review is to go on. But I would say that the people who are in receipt of this money and who we have been in contact with and who have cooperated, the disability community, as I said, have been an enormous help to us in all of this. I would just say to them that, you know, we're very conscious of the contribution that this money makes to their income on
20%.
A monthly basis. Well, I don't think they look at it in that respect. What they look at it as...
But that's what it is.
Well, yes, but would they look at it as money which in fact they can use in order to ensure that they're not stuck at home every day? And we were conscious of that from the very start. And again, as I say, I can't guarantee anything beyond October other than to say that up to this point we have been very conscious of the needs of that vulnerable group, and we will continue to be conscious of their needs. And I would just like to reassure people this morning, you know, that they now have certainty until a new scheme is introduced.
They have certainty until October.
Until a new scheme is introduced. And when we go back to government in October to lay out the broad outlines of what we intend to do, then I think those people, again, have certainty until then. But there, I can't guarantee after that, other than to say that as conscious as we have been about their vulnerability up to this point, we will continue to have that very centrally in our minds.
Minister, on a separate issue, the Cabinet meeting this morning to look at the draft protection of life during pregnancy bill. Is there anything you believe that can be done at this late stage to alleviate the fears and the concerns, particularly of some backbenchers within Fine Gael, and particularly in light of the comments made yesterday by the Irish Catholic bishops?
Well, I've believed from the outset, I think at the very first interview in relation to this whole issue, I've always believed that the Church has a right to its opinion and indeed has a right to have that opinion listened to. As legislators, we legislate for the entire community, not just people of a particular religious denomination, no matter what our own views are. You have to legislate for everyone. And what we're doing in this legislation is ensuring that doctors have a degree of certainty that when they act in order to save the life of a woman, that they are acting within the law. And I believe that there has been regular consultation with everyone, both in Fine Gael and Labour, on an ongoing basis around this legislation. And I believe people will be quite happy. Not everyone, of course.
For further late changes then, no?
No.
Catherine Lynch, Minister of State of the Department of Health, thank you.
Let's go to Australia now, where the Victoria State Premier has ordered a review of the parole laws in that state after the murder of Jill Maher. Dennis Napthine was speaking at a news conference yesterday after it emerged that her killer had been convicted of more than 20 rapes and assaults in the past.
There is no doubt the system failed Jill Maher. Along with all Victorians, I share the admiration we all feel for the enormously dignified way in which Jill Maher's family have conducted themselves through this horror and the way they've conducted themselves through this whole process. Our special thoughts and prayers and love are with them. Victorians expect our cities and towns to be places of safety. Parole in Victoria is a privilege, not a right. That is why my government has changed the Victorian parole laws so that sex and violent offenders who commit further offences while on parole will go straight back to jail. Straight back to jail. This also applies at the point of charge and conviction, which makes this the toughest parole regime in Australia. Under the changes we've already introduced, the offender would have been back in jail, not on the streets. We have also engaged former High Court Judge Ian Callanan to review the structure of the parole board and appointments to the parole board and the operation of the parole board in Victoria. We treat these matters as very serious matters. The system was flawed. The system failed Gilmar.
And that's the Victoria Premier Dennis Napthine speaking at a news conference yesterday in Melbourne after that pre-sentence hearing, which was attended by RT's Catriona Perry, who's on the line now. Catriona, he's obviously very unhappy about this and feels something would have to be done quickly about it. Has there been much reaction, political and otherwise, to the outcome of the hearing yesterday?
Particular, I guess, to what happened yesterday, a sense of bewilderment as well as to how a person with the history of violent sexual offending for over 20 years could actually have been free to walk the streets of Melbourne. People just can't seem to be able to get over that point, especially the fact that not only was he let out on parole with 3 years still to serve.
We'll just hold on a minute to see it. Katrina, is she back? Katrina, if you can hear us, go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, sorry, I think the line is quite bad from the other side of the world here where I am at the moment. But I was just saying there about the shock that people are discussing quite openly here in Melbourne at the moment. It's the lead story on all of the newspapers. Yesterday it was the lead story on all.
And unfortunately, it looks like we're not having much joy with that line. We'll see if we can get Katrina back online, a slightly better line, hopefully, later in the programme. But now it's 26 minutes past eight.
Now, imagine you're watching a panel discussion on primetime and suddenly your screen goes blank. And then you learn it's not the fault of your television, but that the state broadcaster has been closed because the government wants to save money. Well, that's what has happened in Greece overnight. The state broadcaster ERT has been closed down by the government there to save money. It is all employees numbering around 2,500 have been suspended. Now, the government says the company would reopen as soon as possible. Let's speak to Professor Helena Sheehan. She's an academic and an activist who has been demonstrating overnight following the closure of the broadcaster. Professor Sheehan, good morning to you.
Kalimera.
Tell us what happened last night.
Well, the news broke yesterday afternoon that the state broadcaster ERT would be going off the air at midnight. So there was a call for people to come to the station, the main station in Athens, at 7 o'clock. So I answered the call and was outside for several hours, and I was also inside occupying the station for a while as well. And it was just the most amazing scene. I'm glad that you mentioned to your viewers to think about if it was RTE, because it is the exact equivalent.
Not to be giving
of
them
the government just suddenly deciding that by ministerial decree, without going into Doyle Aaron, and even Fine Gael doing it without getting the consent of the Labour Party, because, by the way, Neo Democratia don't have the consent of the other two parties, DMAR and PASOK, and just doing it, and not only announcing that they're going to do it by midnight, but they actually started doing it at 10, and by 11:30 it was gone.
Helena,
imagine that.
In the hours between the announcement and them actually shutting it down, I gather that a lot of people who wouldn't have had an awful lot of time for the government were brought on air to express their views in the final few hours of broadcast.
Absolutely, absolutely. A lot of people now would be very critical of ERT, the way a lot of people in Ireland might be very critical of RTE, as maybe not giving proper voice to all points of view. And sometimes, I would say this myself, speaking with the voice of the masters of the universe. And nevertheless, if RTE were, if this happened to RTE, I'd be out there as well. So a lot of the people that were there last night protesting were people who were actually very critical of ERT. But in the broadcast that went out between the time it was announced and it was taken off the air, and is continuing now on live stream and on other frequencies, they were doing the sort of broadcasting they should have been doing all the time. And yes, it was one voice after another denouncing the government and denouncing the Troika. And the scene outside of ERT was fantastic last night. It was one of the most powerful and beautiful demonstrations I've ever seen. And I'm an activist for a long time, and I've seen quite a lot. I mean, they were singing these Theodoraki songs and, you know, waving flags and clenching their fists in the night air. It was so powerful. And the immediacy of the situation made it very powerful.
Helena, as you said, a lot of people have been critical of ERT, as most people are of their state broadcaster, while it had been running. But how reflective would it have been of the mood of the country over the last couple of years? Would it have reported in full with the state's backing on the level of protest and disillusionment there was amongst Greek people?
Well, the Greek people I know say no. They say no, that it wasn't doing that. But, I mean, I've been living in Dublin. I come and go to Greece.
Yes.
So, but that's what the people I talk to in Greece say to me, that it hasn't been doing that satisfactorily.
8:30, I'll get to the news headlines in just a moment. And the plan for the station now, they don't plan to close it forever, do they?
Well, they say that they're going to reopen it again in a scaled-down way, and that obviously means, you know, even more hand-picked people. And you know, it'll be something different. But there's a massive reaction. You know, that all media unions are on strike today. And there's the two major unions, the private and the public sector unions, are calling for a general strike tomorrow.
Professor Leela Sheehan, thank you very much for speaking to us. That's Professor Sheehan in Athens on the closure, the sudden closure of the state broadcaster in Greece overnight. 8:36, Darren Frettl is back with more sports news and news of how a second string Irish team held the world champions to just 2 goals last
night. Yeah, makes a change, doesn't it, Kevin, from a Gdansk last summer. The Republic of Ireland lost 2-0 to Spain in their international friendly in New York earlier this morning. The Irish kept the world and European champions at bay for 69 minutes. Soldado opened the scoring. Sean St. Ledger then had a goal ruled offside 10 minutes from the end. But Spain wrapped up victory when Juan Mata made it to 2-0 in the 88th minute. St. Ledger, a little unlucky with his goal being disallowed. It was actually Simon Cox who was offside in the build-up, but St. Ledger admitted that the referee's assistant made the right call.
It's actually, I think, a really good decision from the linesman.
Yeah.
Having seen it again. To be fair, I thought we actually did a lot better than what we did in Poland. You know, they're an unbelievable side. I think they had most of the ball. Well, they do that to nearly every team in the world. We obviously watched highlights of the France game, and I think the possession stats were probably nearly just the same here. So it's not just us. They're a fantastic side, and I can't see too many other winners in the World Cup next year. You're always up against it because they keep so much of the ball, and you just hopefully maybe that you can get a breakaway, you can get a corner, and hopefully get a goal. You know, but they're a fantastic side. Can't speak highly enough of them. And then you look at the players that they're bringing off. You bring Mata and Cazorla on, who play for a top four Premiership side, so they wear you down. But I think that we can take confidence from the performance. You know, like I say, it was a great experience to play in this stadium.
Well, I'm joined on the line by our soccer correspondent, Tony O'Donoghue. Tony, defeat for the Irish team, but I suppose it's very important to stress as well that this wasn't the first choice selection from Giovanni Trapattoni. Who impressed last night and who didn't?
Well, it was a very good performance by Ireland when you consider last year beaten 4-0 in Gdansk. This year to be beaten 2-0 by a top Spain team is no disgrace at all. I have to say the goalkeeper David Ford, once again, he's really grown into the role and he was outstanding. Seamus Coleman played really well. He was playing picked as such in midfield, but really he was a second fullback. He played really well. So too did James McCarthy inside him. And the much maligned Conor Salmon, I have to say, he had a great chance in the first half where he robbed Piqué and was one-on-one with the keeper, but he also showed some really deft touches for a big man. So, you know what, coming to a game like this against a team as good as Spain, it's like a finishing school really for footballers, like third level education. I think they'll have learned an awful lot from last night.
And what about some of the younger players, how do they fare?
Well, Jeff Hendrick was given a start and he did well in midfield, although he only lasted 45 minutes. But again, a player that Trapattoni has great time for, and you can see a big future for him in the game. Stephen Quinn has been very impressive in training and he did well also. When you look at it, only St. Ledger and Keane started for Ireland 12 months ago. So there's a huge change in personnel, as I say, against a really good Spanish team that we could have got something out of it. So what was also important, I think, that the spirit of the team was excellent compared to last year in the 4-0. The spirit last year was shown by the fans, but there was a good solid unit and certainly hope for the future.
Tony, there was also a very important game in Gothenburg last night. Sweden beat the Faroe Islands 2-0. What impact does that result have on Group C in the World Cup qualifiers?
Well, it's so tight now. Both, well, all of Austria, Sweden and Ireland on 11 points with the goal difference between them. Only two goals for Sweden. Zlatan Ibrahimovic with the goals. Ireland scored three against the Faroes. Germany scored three against the Faroes. Ibrahimovic as well really should have had a yellow card. He wrestled with the centre half. He threw the ball at the head of one of the Faroes defenders. And if he had got a yellow, that would have meant he'd have missed the game in Dublin. So it's really going to be down to fine margins now. The next two games, Ireland against Sweden at home, and then they travel to Austria 4 days later. While Ireland are playing Sweden, Germany play Austria. It really is almost too close to call.
Yeah, and finally, Tony, it's a very important day in Irish soccer history. I want you to remind everyone, is it time the 12th of June was made up national holiday?
Well, you know, we have bank holidays for Leicester, really, 25 years ago, and I remember it all too well. Ray Houghton put the ball in the back of the England net in Stuttgart and maybe changed the face of Irish football forever. So it would be very nice to believe that next year in Brazil that we can compete with the big boys again and make some new memories.
Wouldn't that be great? Tony, thanks very much for that. Now, Longford Town player Colm James has been banned from all football-related activities for 18 months. He's been found guilty of breaching rules on corruption and gambling. Reports this morning, more reports that Luis Suarez will leave Liverpool this morning. A late goal by Marty Kavanagh earned Carlos Hurlers a 2-point win over Dublin in the Bord Gáis Energy Under 21 Championship last night. Cavan football manager Terry Hyland has named an unchanged team for Sunday's quarter final against Fermanagh. Members of the Irish rugby squad touring North America have been hit by a stomach bug. A number of the squad are in isolation. The US Golf Open gets underway on Thursday. For a change, Rory McIlroy going into this event under the radar. The world number two admits he's struggled with his results this season but believes he needs just one good round to turn things around. He feels the course at Merion and the wet conditions at the East Course may play into his hands this week. He's been speaking to Greg Allen.
But you know, when I played it last week, it was still pretty receptive and I was just thinking if it could stay like that, it would be perfect. You know, there was a bit of rain obviously the last few days and you know, made the course very receptive and very soft and probably going to play into my hands a little bit more, which is obviously a good thing for me.
And from your own perspective and the way you're playing and the season you've had and the high achievement levels you had towards the end of last year, how do you feel when you hear people saying, oh, Rory's struggling, but how do you feel inside yourself coming into a week like this?
I feel good. I mean, my game is in good shape. You know, I've been seeing a lot of positive signs in my game the last few weeks and I just need to try and put it all together. And, you know, if I can do that and get on a run, you know, you never know what can happen. But, you know, I'm feeling good. I think, you know, this week for me, it's all about putting it in the fairway. And if I can put it in the fairway, I'm going to have a good chance to score and, you know, to make some birdies when I can. And, but yeah, so for me this week, just I think it's the key for everyone this week is put the ball in the fairway. And if you can do that, you're going to do well.
It's hard to think of Rory McIlroy slightly under the radar as world number two, but there's a lot of attention in Tiger. There's a lot of attention on Webb Simpson and others. Do you find that the kind of the sharing out of attention is okay for you?
Yeah, I don't mind it at all. You know, as I said, the two majors that I've won, I've sort of came in a little bit under the radar. You know, I don't think people were expecting me to bounce back, you know, so quickly after the Masters. And then, you know, I was going through a little bit of a struggle going into the PGA last year. So, you know, it's nice to come in, you know, as you said, probably not under the radar, but maybe just with a little less attention than I usually get, which, you know, has allowed me to go about my business and do my thing and get my preparation done. So, you know, by the time I tee it up on Thursday, I'll be ready to go.
Yeah, lots of positive talk there from Rory McIlroy. Let's hope his game is in order come Thursday. Carl.
Darren, thank you. Let's go back to Katrina Perry in Melbourne and hopefully on a better line. Katrina, we've heard about the political reaction and obviously promises to change the system after what happened in the case of Jill Maher. What about the media coverage? Has the trial, the dreadful stories we heard and the impact statements of the family, has all that got much media coverage?
Well, it wouldn't be an underestimation here to say that there has been absolutely blanket coverage of this story in the media here in Australia, especially in Melbourne. The two main Melbourne newspapers, The Herald Sun and The Age, have given over their entire front pages to the case. The Herald Sun reproducing that wedding photo that people are very familiar with at this stage, with the headline, "My Eternal Love, Tom's Agony," and they've a quote then from his victim impact statement yesterday: "What was stolen from us was our future, the possibility of a family and our lives together." And then the sub-headline is, "How the justice system failed Jill." And then the Age newspaper, the other Melbourne newspaper here, has pictures of Adrian Bailey getting into the prison van and a little inset of Jill then. And the headline there is, "He should have been in jail." And the subheadline, "A catastrophic failure of the justice system." Now, the national newspaper, The Australian, doesn't actually put it on the front page at all. It has it on page two, but perhaps that's because there are two huge political stories dominating the media, apart from the Jill Maher story at the moment here. So they've given over a huge amount of page two to the story. The headline there, "Killer Should Have Never Been on the Streets." The columnists in all of the newspapers here, as you might imagine, are not pulling any punches when it comes to laying blame firmly at the feet of the parole board and the justice system. Some very strong words. At one point, Greg Davies, the Police Association Secretary, is quoted as saying, "This young woman spent the last moments of her life being raped in abject terror because someone thought they could rehabilitate a serial rapist." All of the papers have given over, the Melbourne papers have given over several pages to the story, and the Herald Sun actually gives its editorial to the issue as well. Very strong words there, perhaps the most strong coverage of all of the media here. Its opening line being, "Yesterday, the Victorian justice system should have been standing in the dock alongside Adrian Bailey."
Katrina Perry in Melbourne, thank you very much.
One of the sports that caught the public imagination at last summer's Paralympic Games in London was blind football. But despite Ireland's passion for soccer, there was no Irish team at the competition. The Football Association of Ireland wants to change that. And at a tournament in Dublin over the weekend, reporter Louise Byrne met some of the players hoping to be selected for Ireland's first blind football team.
Are you ready? Okay, let's go.
Centre field in a five-a-side football match at University College Dublin. A shout from the right.
Keep going. 16, 7 feet. Keep going. To your right.
A pass from the left. But these players can't see the ball, their teammates or the goal.
I'm Kevin Kelly. I'm originally from Donegal, now living in Dublin, and I lost my sight when I was 14 due to retinal attachments. So like the release of playing football again when I lost my sight almost 12 years ago, I never thought that I'd be able to play football in any sort of game setting again. It's an amazing feeling to be out there playing again, and the games are as competitive as you've probably seen yourself. There's a few knocks out there on the pitch as well.
Kevin is part of a national development squad with ambitions to compete for Ireland at the Paralympics. This fundraising tournament is for sighted and blind players, with blindfolds levelling the playing field.
I'm Stuart Lawler. I'm manager of the Rehabilitation Training Centre at NCBI in Drumcondra. So blind football is five people on a team. Four people are blindfolded, or maybe they're blind already. The person in goals is sighted. And the ball, which I have in my hand here, Louise, rattles. So as the ball moves around the pitch, it rattles, so the blind players, or the players who are blindfolded, will know where it is.
The FAI spends €250,000 a year on football for all projects, including blind football. CEO John Delaney describes the first time he saw a blind team playing the beautiful game.
Extraordinary, because you know, you can hear about it, how good it is, but when you see it, you remember Ray Houghton and a few of the former players come to see it at our AGM, and Ray was just bowled over.
He did it in Beijing and he's done it again in London. Jason Smith is once more a Paralympic gold medalist.
The star of the London Paralympics and Ireland's best known visually impaired athlete, Jason Smith, is proving an inspiration to Olympic hopefuls like Dunica McCarthy, who became fully blind when he was just 11 years old.
Kind of made me even more determined, like, it's a big possibility that we could be on that Olympic stage in 4, maybe 8 years' time.
Committed to his sport, Dunica isn't fazed by blind football's most common hazard.
The main injury that players get is bloodied or broken noses. So players just running into each other or knocking heads or anything. I suppose you get it in every sport, but more so in blind football. You're not caring about if you're going to get injured, you just care about getting the ball.
Dunica's sighted friends joined his team today. So what did they make of playing in the dark?
So you've just come off the pitch there. That was your first ever game of blind football. How did you find it?
I thought it was extremely hard, actually. It was a lot harder than I thought it would be. I had no idea where the goals were, so I didn't know what way to point, what way to shoot. You know?
After, I'd say, definitely about 2 minutes in the block, you get very disorientated, you know? You literally can't tell what's up from down, you know?
The FAI says the 2020 Paralympics is a realistic target for an Irish team.
Well, they'll get something. I know I've never got. They get a cap for playing for their country, and we have a football forward presentation of caps every year. It's an extraordinary, extraordinary presentation. The pride that the participants have in getting their caps, the pride that the parents and their families have in seeing their son or their daughter getting a cap for their country, it's overwhelming, actually.
For the blind players, when it comes to their Paralympic ambitions, not seeing is believing.
Who knows, we might put the sighted international team to shame if we were to come back with a trophy or a medal sometime in the future. Most people, whether they've got a disability or not, love to represent their country at something, and mean to play at the European Championship, the World Cup, or even the Paralympics in the longer term would be such a proud day. And maybe losing my sight all those years ago, it all happened for a reason.
Kevin Kelly ending that report from Louise Byrne.
Our education correspondent Emma Kelly joins us to tell us more about this apology issued by the State Exams Commission. What exactly are they apologising for, Emma?
Well, yeah, the State Examinations Commission issued a further statement yesterday evening. It contained three additional pieces of information. First of all, an apology. This was for more than the error that we know all about on question 8 of Friday's Leaving Cert Higher Level paper, but for other errors as well, which I'll get onto in a moment. But they called this most regrettable, and they apologised, and they acknowledged that this could have caused distress and confusion, and that's really what they were apologising for. So, but beyond the apology as well, this statement set out four errors very clearly. Now, some of these errors, they vary in terms of their importance, shall we say. We have the error that we know about in question 8. We also were aware yesterday afternoon of several other errors. In fact, errors that were raised on Morning Ireland yesterday morning by Catherine Lewis. A project maths paper, this would have been one going to a small number of schools, 23 schools, contained material that wasn't on the syllabus. That was an ordinary level maths paper 1. Also, the foundation level paper, there was a typographical error on that. Also, a junior certificate higher level paper, there was another small error relating to a number on that paper as well. Now, the third piece of information we got on this statement was the background to all this. The State Examination Commission laid out again the sort of chain of responsibility. It also sort of outlined what a huge task this is, especially in the area of maths this year. The State Examinations Commission is producing double the number of maths papers that they would normally produce. This is because the syllabus is in transition. We have a new project maths syllabus coming in. We have an old syllabus that is still around, that has been withdrawn, let's say. So they pointed out that they had 44 different maths papers this year to prepare. That's double the number that they would normally have. On top of that, they had 44 contingency papers to prepare, because one always has to have a contingency paper in case there is a security breach. So again, we got some background on a little bit of context on what's going on.
By the way, in case you're wondering, we did ask the Exams Commission to provide us with somebody to explain what had happened. Not available today, as indeed they weren't available yesterday. So I suppose the obvious question is, Emma, to whom are they accountable? To whom does the Commission report?
The Commission reports to the Minister for Education. Now, the Minister for Education, Rory Quinn, sent out a statement yesterday as well, saying one thing, first of all, saying notwithstanding checks and balances, errors can and do occur. And that's a point, I think, that has to be taken on board. I mean, no system is perfect. Mistakes happen. Really, what is interesting is what happens once a mistake happens and how does a body deal with it. But Minister Rory Quinn went on in his statement to say that he would be looking for a report on the issue. What will happen now is, and both Rory Quinn's statement is saying this, and the State Examinations Commission says, in the context of errors such as these, the SEC reviews its existing processes and procedures in order to strengthen those procedures. So that is what will happen now. There will be a review carried out. It's not the first time that the SEC is constantly reviewing when errors occur or when there are glitches. And they will review and see if there's a way of strengthening this area. And they've also been asked to report to the minister. I should also say that in the statement they pointed out that the person who has chief responsibility for the setting and proofreading of these papers within the SEC is the chief examiner in that subject.
All right, Emma, thank you very much. And by the way, there is another educational matter on the agenda today. This is in the Oireachtas, where the Education Committee will be talking to members of the History Teachers Association who have concerns about the position of history in the junior cert. But that's for today. For now, it's 5 to 9.
Pictures of smiling babies will be banned from all tins of baby formula milk under new EU moves to stop the hard sell of these products and to stop breastfeeding being undermined, according to a report in the Irish Independent this morning. Let's speak to Professor Alan Kelly. He's Chief Executive of the Food Safety Authority. Professor Kelly, good morning.
Yes, it's Professor Riley, Alan Riley. Good morning. How are you?
My apologies, Professor Riley. Do you welcome this move?
Yes, indeed. The Food Safety Authority of Ireland would welcome this.
Why?
What it means is that follow-on formula is now going to be governed by the same rules as infant formula. And really, the specific rules apply to things like the sale, advertising, and labelling of follow-on formula. You know, essentially, breast is best. It's that simple. And what the legislation is trying to do is to ensure that that message stays to the forefront, and that these follow-on formulas, these infant formulas, they don't idealise the formula and give us any, if you like to call it any, what can I say, the, you know, any advantage, you know, over breastfeeding. Really, breastfeeding is best, and these products should not be marketed to downgrade breastfeeding in any way.
But what about for some mothers for whom breastfeeding may not be an option for whatever reason, whether they find it extremely difficult, whether for work reasons? While the health benefits are clear, it doesn't work for every woman. Why the demonization of formula products by now removing the image of a smiling child from the tin?
Well, it's not. I think pictures and text on labels which idealize such formula, you know, are to be banned. It's in really the purpose of the legislation is not to discourage breastfeeding and not to idealize these type of products.
But how does a smiling child on a tin of formula milk discourage breastfeeding?
Well, you know, in the advertising of such products in such a way as to idealize bottle feeding over breastfeeding, you know, is banned under European rules. It's that simple.
And now it's extending it to a product that's available between 6 to 12 months.
It's extending it to a whole range of products that weren't in the loop. These are the follow-on formula, growing up milk, as they're called in the regulations. The same rules with respect to the sale, advertising, and labelling of these products will apply.
Do you know how soon this is going to be in place?
It will take, you know, some time. The legislation has been signed, but for it to come into force, it will probably take a couple of months.
And do you really think it's going to make any difference? Do you really think it's going to discourage people from using formula feed it's necessary?
You know, I think all the evidence is that we have to date, and I mean, say that would be, you know, the evidence on which the actual regulations are based, you know, would say, yes, you know, idealizing the use of formulas of bottle feeding discourages women from breastfeeding.
Professor Alan Riley, Chief Executive of the Food Safety Authority, thank you for speaking to us. It's 1 to 9.